Excessive prayer, I haven't seen this anywhere else, but that doesn't mean it's not true, but it doesn't mean it's true either. But passive prayer would seem to me, at any rate, to be the prayer typical of childhood. For a child can do nothing except receive. A child must mature, however. We have to learn to own our life. We have to develop our ego. We have to separate from parents, loving as they are, and find out who I am. We have to explore creative ways of acting in the world and of relating to the mystery that we call God. We've been exploring some of what this means in parts 1 and 2 of this book. However, there comes a stage in the development of our communion with God when we're called to let go control and allow God to draw us beyond active prayer, at least as an habitual practice. We must learn to yield to God's love. It may be that age teaches us this in other areas too. I've got good health, thank God, and so I haven't come to this stage yet, but it can't be too long before I will need people to care for me and need to say, look, I'm sorry, I can't do it anymore. Do you know what I mean? That can't be too far around the corner. And I imagine that will have to teach me to receive rather than give and to let go and all that that requires. And in the final analysis, we've got to let go of everything when we die. So there must be a natural process of that. John of the Cross likens prayer to the playing, this is a beautiful image, of a musical instrument. Inspired by God and enabled by God's grace, in active prayer, we are, as it were, practicing the art of playing the strings of our heart and mind, learning to ponder the mystery of God and enjoy the harmony of experiencing communion. In passive prayer, we leave it to God to guide our fingers over the strings. God puts his arm around you while you're holding the guitar and actually moves the strings for you. Shows you where to put your fingers and so on. Teresa explains the difference between what I talked about last week, simplified active prayer, the prayer of presence, and the beginnings of passive prayer. See if this rings bells for your experience. She says, when God grants this favour, it is a great help to seek him within, where he is found more easily and in a way more beneficial to us than when sought in creatures, as Augustine says, after having looked for God in many places. Brackets, that itself is interesting, how the saints help each other. Augustine was helped by Athanasius's writing on the famous Saint Anthony of the Desert. That was the moment that struck him. Here we've got Teresa reading Augustine and learning from him. So that's what we do. We belong to a church, thank God, that is not dependent on a local charismatic preacher who comes up with all kinds of balmy or good ideas, a mixture from nowhere, if you know what I mean, claiming God. We have the great fortune of belonging to a church that's as old, and we've got saints all the way along, sinners too, but we've got all this stuff to learn from that's been tested by time and transcultured, and it's wonderful to know that your basic core of your belief is something that people have believed for 2,000 years. Isn't that better than 2 weeks? So, St. Augustine says this. So, do not think that this recollection is acquired by the intellect striving to think about God within itself. Such efforts are good. They're an excellent kind of meditation because they're founded on a truth, which is that God is within us. But this is not the prayer of recollection, because it's something which each of us can do with the help of God, as should be understood of everything. What I'm speaking of, she says, and she's talking about the beginnings of contemplative prayer, what I'm speaking of comes in a different way, Sometimes, before even beginning to think of God, one noticeably senses a gentle drawing inward. This doesn't come when we want it, but when God wants to grant us this favour. And what I shared with you earlier about the examine of consciousness is there to help us if we were too busy at the moment of grace later to think, oh, as I was walking down the street, you know, to recall it, pick it up again and get it on the bounce, as it were, so we don't let it just go. When we let go the attempt to control our prayer, we allow a gentle drawing inward. Earlier we were trimming our sails to tack with the gentle breeze. What a good thing to do if you're a sailor. Now we experience ourselves being drawn to let go and yield to an attraction that draws us and over which we exercise no control. The recollection experienced here is not the result of our decision to simplify our method of praying. It's not the fruit of our controlling our breathing or practicing a mantra, all of which are good things to do. It's an experience that we're powerless to induce. Both Teresa and John warn us not to attempt to manufacture this quiet for ourselves. There are techniques that people can teach you to still your body, to do your breathing, to practice a mantra. You know, there's all these things to do, good. They're certainly good for your blood pressure, and they could even be good for your prayer. But they're not what we're talking about here. You can't practice this. You can prepare for it by practicing other things, but this prayer is not that. You can't manufacture this silence. There's nothing wrong with practicing techniques to quieten ourselves down, so long as we don't confuse this with the quiet that is God's gift, the quiet that comes with passive prayer. John of the Cross writes, "You must be content simply with a loving and peaceful attentiveness to God. You must live without the concern, without the effort, and without the desire to taste or feel God. All these desires disquiet the soul and distract you from the peaceful quiet and sweet idleness of the contemplation which is being communicated to you." Now, the drying up of our thoughts and feelings is necessary. This is the problematic area of prayer, the beginnings of contemplative prayer. It's quite problematic, quite difficult, can be. Because your thoughts have to go. All our thoughts about God have got something to do with God. If they're good thoughts, they point us in the direction of God. If they're bad thoughts, they're a dash nuisance. But if even the thoughts you have about God that you learn in theology, if they point you towards God, they're not God. Are you with me? That's all they are. And they only point you there. So you can't hang on to them. It's like hanging on to the bottom rung of a ladder when you want to climb the roof, because it's been a very good rung and it's been very safe and it got you where you are, 2 feet off the ground. So you hang on to it because you know it's very secure. Well, I've got a secret for you. You're never going to get to the roof if you hang on to the bottom rung. So you might have to let some. At first we'll wonder whether the drying up is the result of our infidelity. Prayer is so much more distracted now than it was 2 years ago, or when you were in a prayer group that was good. And you might think it's your fault. And it may be, by the way. We may know deep down that we're being called to give up some addictive behaviour or to rearrange our priorities, but we're not yet willing to do so. Even addiction to prayer. Half consciously, we avoid intimacy in our contact with God because we know that if we do experience it, we'll have to look away or be faced with the unwillingness to change our lives. if I'm living a life that's hypocritical, living two lives, how am I going to look God in the eye and pray? It's not going to be too comfortable, is it? So I'll have to look away. And isn't that what people do when they're living two lives? In the intimacy of the family, they get busy somewhere so they don't have to look you in the eye, because something's going on. And you'll see it if you look into their eyes. So this is the same with prayer. So the easiest way to put off repentance is to put off prayer. Up to this point, we've been finding joy in considering the truths of our faith, let's say. God is now drawing us to experience the gaze of the one for whom our hearts long. If we accept the loss of the joys to which we've grown accustomed, and if we abandon ourselves in trust to the actions of Jesus' Spirit in our souls, we'll be transformed by the all-consuming love that is God. Like a drop of water, we're being drawn into the ocean of God's love and being absorbed into it. Accompanying this experience of love, there is joy, as well as a sense of belonging, communion, and peace. This is the love for which we are made and for which we long. We are more aware than before of the fact that the silence, the stillness, the welling up of joy or gratitude or sorrow or pleading is from God. We sense that. We're also more aware than before of the fact that we can do nothing to obtain it. This awareness that we can do nothing to attain it is essential, for there could be nothing worse than our taking any credit for the communion that God is now giving us. And be careful who you tell about it if you have any of these experiences. Tell your spiritual director or someone you absolutely need to tell. But when people start talking about, they call it witness, and they talk about their intimate prayer experiences, dangerous ground. I don't say it never should happen, but you're in very dangerous waters, because can't you see that it could be a bit of an ego thing too, very readily and easily. So it's a sensitive area. This is spiritual pride, if we took pride in what was happening to me and my healing powers and my ability to read hearts and my, you know. It doesn't take long to think this person's actually talking about themselves and not God. This is spiritual pride, the most dangerous sin, and one that would surely lead God to having to hold back the communion that God was wanting to give us. God knows how harmful spiritual pride is for us, and out of mercy, God would have to hold back grace in which we were taking pride. He'd have to do it, because we're doing harm to others and to ourselves with it. We might well be able to confect our own form of spiritual silence in order to carry on the self-deception, but it would not be true contemplation. The long winters that we experience at this stage of our prayer journey, long winters in which nothing seems to be happening, help preserve us from spiritual pride, for we know from hard experience that contemplation is a gift from God. There really is nothing we can do to acquire it, apart, as I've already said, from preparing our souls for it. We can clear away the undergrowth, we can dig the well, but we cannot create the spring. We learn to listen to Jesus as he tells us that we'll find ourselves only when we learn to lose, we had it yesterday in the Gospel, to lose ourselves. We have to become like little children if we wish to enter the domain of love into which he's inviting us. There comes a time when we're ready to let go the ego that we've developed and to surrender in love to God. It's when we begin to surrender in this way that we begin to experience intermittent moments of this most profound communion. If we're willing to remain open to these grace moments, when God draws us into divine communion beyond all our thoughts and feelings, and if we resist the temptation to take control of them, or to possess them, or to attempt to reproduce them by our own efforts or techniques, God's longing to be in communion with us is such that transient experiences of recollection tend to deepen so that the soul finds itself wrapped in quiet prayer. John of the Cross assures us that the surest sign that this prayer is from God, and I quote, he says, is that we take pleasure in being alone and wait with loving attentiveness upon God without making any particular meditation in inward peace and quiet and rest. You're like a lizard on a cold winter's day around the back of the house where it's a bit warm and the sun is shining on you, and after all the freezing cold, you just sit there quietly, or maybe getting the sun through the glass on the back veranda. You're just letting God love you quietly. In fact, Teresa calls it the prayer of quiet. When we were in control of our prayer, we worked for such quiet. Now the quiet wells up from mysterious depths of the soul. We're drawn into an experience of prayer from within. Earlier, we found ways to quieten our imagination, our memory, and our mind. We talked about that a bit last week. Now, surprised by grace, these same faculties of imagination, memory, and mind are absorbed, and they're looking as though in wonder at what they see. It is this looking as though in wonder that explains the word contemplation. That's what it means. Now the only water that is refreshing the garden of the soul, says Teresa, comes from its own source, which is God. From the centre of our soul, the fire of God's love radiates out and, says Teresa, the warmth and the fragrant perfume spread through the entire soul. You know how she likens the soul to a seven mansions, a castle, 16th century, typical of Spain, and there are seven. And in the middle one, there's a hearth, a fire, and God. And we're out there. And we're working, being drawn gradually to the warmth. And contemplation starts about halfway in, and we're drawn in and in and in like that to the presence of God. Teresa, again, in passive prayer, our attention is not on insights received, important though they are. Nor is our attention on any accompanying psychosomatic phenomena that we may experience. I've written a bit of that in my book too, and some of it is, I talk about levitation and ecstasies and, you know, all these things you would have read about. But be very careful, because all the mystics say that's a sign of human weakness. That's not a sign of grace. They're a sign of the inability of the psyche to cope with the experience. So don't be wanting them. The best contemplative experience might be the most sanest person you've ever had, who can cope with it without going and hurtling off into some kind of ecstasy. So don't look for the phenomena, or don't wish you had them, or don't be impressed by them. If someone has an ecstasy, you should say, the poor thing, she needs a cup of tea. No, seriously, she probably needs a cup of tea and something nice to warm her up. I don't know. But the point I'm making is really quite serious. They're not the prayer. They're the psychic phenomena that go with it if you're hysterical or whatever, not so well, or if you're like us, weak human being. Our attention is to be on God, who brings about the transforming union effected by love. In contemplation, we're purified, enlightened, and united to God in love. We're being transformed into love by the all-consuming love that is God, like a log transformed into flame by an all-consuming fire, favorite image of John of the Cross. Put a log on the fire, the water in it, etc., and it blackens, doesn't it? It does all this stuff, and then finally comes down to these lovely coals while you sit there sipping Glenfiddich. See the luxury I live in? So, we're being transformed into love like this log. In contemplation, God communicates a secret wisdom that God infuses into the soul through love. Supernatural contemplation is sustained above all by peaceful surrender and humility. In the words of Teresa, the important thing is not to think much, but to love much. Love doesn't consist in great delight, but in desiring with strong determination to please God in everything. We should be wary of setting strict guidelines for what to do when God grants us the gift of contemplation. God is directing us now, and God's light is lighting our way, however faintly and intermittently. Furthermore, people differ greatly. We should offer ourselves in peaceful and silent surrender to God. You may have asked people at some stage of your life, you may even still do it, and we can all do it, you may ask people how to love well. And there are people around you who'd have good advice to offer you, but no one's going to tell you how to love, are they? Mm-hmm. They can't. They can only give you some wise direction. Eventually, we all have to do it our way, and it's totally unique. St. Teresa writes, "Abandon yourselves into the arms of love, and His Majesty will teach you what to do next. Almost the whole work is to realize your unworthiness to receive such great good, and to occupy yourself in giving thanks." The spirit that moves us in prayer is the spirit that Jesus shares with His Father. That's the spirit, that's our Christian belief, that the spirit moving in our hearts is Jesus' own love spirit. Through this gift, we're being drawn to share Jesus' own prayer communion with God. This communion always comes as a surprise and a gift of love. We experience it when we yield to the divine attraction drawing us into God. We can long for this communion with God, and we can prepare for it, but there's nothing we can do to bring it about. Only the gift of the Spirit can cause to well up within us the spring of living water promised by Jesus. When the water is flowing, all striving ceases. Words are no longer relevant, and we find ourselves caught in the silent wonder of this communion. Like a drop of water, we're being drawn into the ocean of God's love and are being absorbed into it.